Hi, I'm Ben Rizzuto, wealth strategist at Janus Henderson Investors. Is a brighter future possible? At Janus Henderson, we think it is. For 90 years, we've worked to help clients achieve superior financial outcomes and fulfill our purpose of investing in a brighter future together. We know that this means our thinking and our investments are helping to shape millions of futures. At Janus Henderson, we are committed to helping you invest in a brighter future for the next 90 years and beyond. To learn more, go to janushenderson.com.
Market insight and analysis. You're listening to the opening bell of CNBC's Squawk on the Street.
Good Tuesday morning. Welcome to Squawk on the Street. I'm Carl Quintanilla with David Faber, Mike Santoli of Post 9 of the New York Stock Exchange. Cramer has the morning off. Futures once again on the hunt for some stability after a near 3% drop over 2 days for the S&P, worst in more than a year. Dow's going to benefit from UNH as corporate earnings pick up some steam. Our roadmap begins with the market volatility. Six negative sessions in a row for the Dow. NASDAQ's coming off its worst day in a couple of months.
We also have a busy day on the earnings front. We've got United Health, Bank of America, Morgan Stanley, Johnson & Johnson, all a beating on the bottom line, although different reaction in the markets. Plus, Sarah Eisen sits down exclusively with the ECB president, Christine Lagarde. They will be discussing inflation, interest rates, and, of course, where the central bank is diverging from the Fed when it comes to rate policy.
Let's begin with the markets today. Stocks look to rebound again. Similar picture in terms of the pre-market is yesterday, but we know how beholden the market is to some of these headlines today.
For sure. And beholden to really what the bond market decides to do with it. The yields are basically still pushing higher at a pretty moderate pace at the moment, but in search of the pain threshold for stocks and for the economy. This has been kind of a similar backdrop to what we had late last year, except with the economy in more secure footing, it seems. So we've basically unwound this idea you could have the immaculate disinflation. Now we're all of a sudden talking about the economy almost in overheat mode, even if that doesn't really hold up longer term. So what have we done or accomplished in the markets so far in April? Well, that long streak of no 2% dips in the S&P, that's over. One of the longer streaks ever with the S&P above its 50-day average, that's over. So you're kind of had this unwind of the momentum and the systematic trade that was very, very long going into all this. And it is a lot of it about whether yields impinge. We haven't had yields above 4.6 on the 10-year in the post-global financial crisis world, except for October of last year. So October of last year, that's what really kind of was the crucible of the deepening of that correction. Where was the S&P then? Under 4,400, 41 to 4,400. So it shows you when earnings come through and the economy is in better shape, it's not a one-to-one. Yields are here, therefore stocks should be here. But if it starts to look like it's in melt-up mode for yields, that's what has backed off the stock market.
Yeah. Interesting fund manager survey out of B of A today where you've got record exposure. Expectations for higher global inflation going back a few years and for global growth. Right.
The no landing scenario is at kind of a record high in the last couple of years of this survey. And that's the world that this new reality has been encountering, which is everybody kind of embracing the idea, not only that the economy was in good shape globally, but that you could have this sort of no trade-offs world where you didn't have to worry about inflation staying higher or maybe the Fed being more patient. You know, it seems mostly all good excuses for the market to have what it needed to have anyway, which is a little bit of a reset. 10% up in the first quarter in the S&P. Every single time that's happened, except for one, the rest of the year was higher. But the smallest pullback along the way was 4%, and that was back in the 1960s. So in the last 50 years, if you're up 10% in the first quarter, the minimum pullback has been 6 or 7%. We're down 4 in the S&P right now.
On more of a day-to-day basis, this time yesterday, we were all remarking on how it seemed somewhat unusual how strong the market appeared to be given the geopolitical tensions we're all well aware of. We're in no better position to understand what the Israeli response will really be right now to the Iranian attack over the weekend. And then we, of course, reversed yesterday.
You
know, anything that you can share, Mike, in terms of how, when it comes to day-to-day and geopolitical tensions and or what may happen in the price of oil and everything else in terms of the overall impact here?
Well, it seemed as if what happened yesterday was the events of the weekend were almost taken by the market as a net de-escalation, right? We didn't think it was going to spiral from here. And then really just oil is your cue. You know, if oil is steady, if it's calm, if it's backing off, it probably tells you that we're not, you know, being held captive to the geopolitical concerns, but then the bonds started to sell off again. Right. So, you know, on Friday, you had this little bit of a haven bid in Treasuries. That was gone. In fact, it became a little bit more of a kind of aggressive sell-off. So, you know, we're looking for that level where bonds either settle out. What's interesting is everyone's saying this morning, oh, stock's getting to look a little bit oversold. Earnings should be a net positive because they are going to beat in aggregate. We kind of know that at this point. And so as we accumulate more earnings reports, that could create more support. But tactically speaking, it's like, okay, did we get oversold? Did we have enough fear to enter this market? And it's sort of maybe kind of at this point. It's not as if it's a clear picture. You have the volatility index toward 20, but not quite above 20 yesterday. And the thing to look for is when bonds start getting bought, because people are worried about the stock market going down and that yields have gone high enough that, in fact, it could pinch off growth. They had a really bad housing starts number this morning, and bonds got a very brief bid, and equity futures rallied just a little bit. But we're talking about small moves.
Yeah, we were talking about multifamily, the print this morning on starts getting awfully close to a decade low. Permits down 4.
Yeah.
We are going to hear from Powell today. And Barkin and Williams,
yep,
and Jefferson actually should be hitting the tape sometime about now.
Yeah, you want to hear just how they're characterizing this sort of 3 straight hot CPI reports. Are we still saying there could be bumps in the road? I doubt there's going to be a big rethink they're going to convey, but I do think that if they kind of stick to the story of we can be patient, the economy's giving us that luxury, but we do have an easing bias, then, you know, that's not new news, but maybe it doesn't resolve everything we'd like to see resolve.
Mike mentions earnings. Certainly, it still is all about the banks. Got an upgrade at Goldman today over at Argus. As they point out, the recent quarter demonstrates the strength of their franchise in what they're calling an investment banking upturn. But David, Morgan Stanley, and B of A, plenty of good metrics to look at.
It would feel like it right now. Both stocks do appear to be higher. Certainly Morgan Stanley coming in with a good quarter. Return on tangible common equity of 19.7% during the quarter. The expense efficiency ratio at 71%, saying what they say at least demonstrates operating leverage. And again, what was a better market environment, we certainly saw Goldman outperform. At least it appeared many of its peers. Morgan Stanley, for its part, remember from the last quarter, it has sort of trudged along as a stock and has underperformed at least the group of the large cap banking sector. But today will be a bit of a different story, at least in the early going here. As you can see, both Bank of America looks to peer up and Morgan Stanley even more so this morning on the strength of these numbers.
It does seem that capital markets and investment banking was a net positive contributor to all the big ones that we've gotten so far. Sometimes it's not the case. Sometimes it's sort of like, who was positioned right. But this seems like there was enough to go around. That seemed to be the margin of upside for B of A, you know, the old Merrill Lynch business. A little bit of leakage in credit on B of A, but it was kind of expected in the credit card area. And most of the lenders on the consumer side are sort of saying, you know, we see this bump in delinquencies. We actually don't think it's going to persist or get worse. It seems as if there was a sort of moment in time from certain vintages of credit balances that maybe are souring. But so I don't think it's alarming, but it's something that's a little bit of a headwind.
Yeah, some of the charge-offs in commercial real estate.
Yes.
Interesting piece in the journal today about big tech not being a pillar,
yes,
of office occupancy as much as it was pre-COVID. And then you talk about the consumer. Average credit card consumer FICO, 777.
Yeah.
Has been trending higher over several quarters. We heard this from Morgan Stanley research a few weeks ago. Sort of, it takes the edge off of the concerns about delinquencies.
It completely does. It's really remarkable. I mean, I know that people have kind of gone back and looked at the pandemic era stimulus and how it essentially just cleaned up a lot of consumer balance sheets. You know, it gets people out of paying minimum payments and all the rest of it. And it seems to have had legs. And of course, you do have those things like, the household financial obligations ratio is very low, even though, inflation has been high and people have built up their balances. And that's basically how much of your disposable income goes to service debt. So, yeah, it seems as if it's sort of around the edges. It's something to be concerned about. When it comes to B of A, it's just about where yields are going to go, where the unrealized losses are, and, you know, the general trend in deposit costs and how sensitive or not they are to every move in Fed rates at this point.
Also want to hit UNH if we can, guys.
Yeah.
I mean, again, one of the larger market cap companies out there at some $410 billion. Going to be a bit higher today as well, Will United Healthcare Group. based on numbers that came in, at least revenue numbers in particular, ahead of expectations. This group has been getting a bit hard hit in terms of some actions from the government side when it came to Medicare Advantage, for example, overall. But in particular, there'd been a lot of concern at UnitedHealth about that cyber attack. We've talked about it. We've been reporting on it. And it is amazing that in some ways the market's willing to overlook what is over $1 billion in costs from a cyber attack. The impact for the quarter totaled about $870 million. That was 74 cents a share. The company on the conference call estimating full year impact, and in the press release, $1.15 to $1.35. That'll be roughly in a range of about $1 billion to $1.15 billion overall for the full year. Those costs are enormous. That said, Mike, the market reaction obviously to the numbers overall is positive, and even perhaps to the fact that that number may have been a bit lower than had been anticipated, as large as it is.
Yeah. Now, the stock was in like a 20% pullback.
Yes.
And you mentioned that they've been hard hit. It kind of goes back to levels it first reached 2.5 years ago. And I think the company's willingness to essentially keep a lot of the guidance steady in terms of medical loss rates, things like that, cleaned up the story just a bit. It does seem as if, you know, you're gonna bounce. You see where it's been on a year-to-date basis. It is, by the way, most of the early Dow futures gain you see is UNH.
If not all, right?
It's about 200 points.
Yeah.
Of the Dow. We do have, I believe it's the CEO talking about the cyber attack and offering at least some perspective. Take a listen.
This was an unprecedented attack by a malicious actor on the U.S. health system. We rapidly deployed resources to develop alternative solutions and moved promptly to restore claims and payment services. We've made substantial progress, and we will not rest until care providers' connectivity needs are met. And to help care providers mitigate workflow disruptions and help ensure the uninterrupted delivery of care, for a period of time, we suspended some care management activities.
A broad impact on the operations of the company. It was focused in the Change Healthcare business, which, by the way, is a company they bought not that long ago. Perhaps they had, overlooked exactly how weak their ability to combat cyber attacks was at the time. I don't know.
But it is remarkable constantly how the market is willing to sort of just say this is an extraordinary event. We'll hive that off and just take it from here and hope that the numbers hold up for the rest of the year in terms of the bottom line.
Yeah. We'll get to J&J as well. Pretty decent guidance in the CFO on Squawk earlier this morning. Still to come, the University of South Carolina's women's basketball team is in the building celebrating their championship. We're going to talk to Coach Staley and first round draft pick Cardoso in just a moment. Take a look at the pre-market as we get another session underway with the Bulls holding the ball. We'll see if it lasts as Squawk on the Street continues.
The spirit of performance defines Acura, and now it's electric. Introducing the all-electric ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. While what powers their cars may change, the energy that makes Acura never will. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system and up to 313-mile range on a single charge, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is everything they said electric could never be. It was built with the driver in mind, just like Acura's been doing since the beginning. We could talk all day, but the only way to experience this electric performance is to drive it yourself. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.
Let's get straight to the point. You want to grow your portfolio to fight rising costs of inflation or pay off your debt or anything standing in the way of you and financial freedom, right? Yahoo Finance, our sponsor today, can help. For more than 25 years, Yahoo Finance has been helping great investors like you. Whether you're a seasoned investor or just looking for tips, Yahoo Finance makes it super easy by putting all the tools and data you need in one spot. Yahoo Finance takes a holistic look at the financial news cycle, including breaking news, original editorial perspectives, analyst ratings, independent research, customizable charts, and more. You can securely link your brokerage accounts for a unified view of your wealth, including 401k and other investments. That's how Yahoo Finance gives you insights and helps you take a look at your wealth in its entirety. That big picture perspective is what great investors need. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com.
University of South Carolina Gamecocks won their second national championship in 3 years, as you know, defeating Iowa, Caitlin Clark, and posting the 10th perfect season in the history of D1 women's college basketball. This morning, they're ringing the opening bell here at the Big Board. And joining us here at Post Tonight, Camille Cardoso, South Carolina Gamecocks center and third overall pick in last night's WNBA draft, and South Carolina head coach Dawn Staley. Ladies, welcome. Good to have you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And thank you for just the amazing season and your incredible interview after the victory. We've been talking a lot about the ratings and sort of what it means for women's sports, but do you think we are in a moment of sorts for women's college basketball, at least?
I do. I do think we're in a moment in which, and I've said this a long time, that I think our game has been held back to now is at a point where it's bursting through the seams, and I don't think we're going to look back. I think it's just going to get better and better.
What do you think's been holding it back?
I do think the decision makers have held our sport back to the point of maybe because they don't think they would get return on their investment. I think now is the time in which they're seeing there's a return on your investment when you pour into our game.
Have you felt that way, that we're in a change? And by the way, congratulations on Monday night. I was looking at the odds for the Sky getting the title, jump more than any other team on Monday.
Thank you. I think our game is improving a lot, and I think there's much more to keep improving.
Talk about the season and how it felt going from beginning to end and knowing that there were so many eyes on you, especially in the Final Four.
I think we had an amazing season. Since our first game, I knew we had an amazing team and we was going to do great things together. So I'm just proud of every single one of those girls.
Does it change? I know you've been doing this a while in terms of recruiting and getting women to come to the school and the sort of path that they're expected to take now in terms of playing to these huge audiences. You actually have, obviously the NBA has been around a while, WNBA has been around a while. But at this point, it seems like a more defined path that people can follow.
Women's basketball is a sport, and it feels like that now. With the good, the bad, the ugly of it, we have it all. We have villains, we have incredible talent in our sport, and it's being highlighted. The good, the bad, and the ugly, again, is being highlighted, and that's what you have in every sport that's here and present.
And by that you mean you get celebrated, and then, of course, the critics come out, right, and the hot takes come out.
Absolutely. So I welcome it all. I welcome the critics. I welcome people thinking that we're not a sport. I welcome because they're taking time out of their day to talk about us not being a sport. So I welcome it all. But we also have people who have marveled over our sport and the people that are in it. So I am super proud of where we are, and I'm encouraged by the future that we'll have.
There's always the money thing. I think there's been so much discussion about NIL and how athletes are compensated that way. But then you look at some of the contracts from Monday night, and I think people are realizing, wait, there's still a lot of disparity. You think that changes?
I don't do NIL, so I don't know.
No.
Well, I do think. I think now we're at a point where, there are more eyeballs on our game and our sport. So they're seeing the disparities, the salary disparities. But I will say the WNBA is moving in the right direction. We're still a very young league, a very, very young league, just like the NBA. The NBA didn't become what it's become, in 28 years. Think about that. So I do think our future is bright. I do think, again, people are going to look at our sport and pour into it because they see dollar signs at the end of the day.
I mean, that has to mean more schools that did not prioritize women's basketball, for example, are going to invest in it, right? And therefore, the competition becomes harder.
I hope every school, every university treats women's basketball and women's sports like the University of South Carolina. They invest. They invest in my salary. They invest in student athletes. And you'll see that they're getting, we're here. We're on a channel that probably everybody goes by real quick. I've done it, but I've stopped to look and see, what this is about. I hope that this is a time in which you'll have more women's basketball coaches here on stage, because I do think our game is going to be rich with talent, and financial gain. Mm.
You were so gracious in your victory interview about Caitlin Clark. Now she's on SNL doing Weekend Update. In order to create the success you're talking about, you need to have superstars, yes?
Caitlin Clark is a superstar. I credit her with raising the level. We're creating more eyeballs on our sport, and we need to thank her for that. And a lot of people think I'm being facetious when I say that. I'm not. I'm all for the greater good of our game. If she's a big part of it, we need to find the next superstar that will take our game to the next level, along with telling the storylines of a team like we had, an undefeated season, a historical season. We need to tell all the stories of our game, and I do think we will.
It's inspiring, Coach. Thank you for
Thank
being
you.
Here, both of you. Congratulations again. We'll be watching in Chicago. And speaking of basketball, you can join the first ever CNBC Changemakers event in New York City on Thursday, April 18th. You'll hear from some changemakers, including the commissioner of the WNBA. Just scan the QR code to learn more. Visit cnbcevents.com/changemakers. Fed out with some March industrial production data a few moments ago, coming up up 0.4. That's in line. Capacity utilization did show a reading of 78.4, also roughly in line with estimates in the 10-year. We continue to watch somewhere around, above 4.6 today, 4.67. Take a quick break here. We're back in a moment. Don't go away.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Still to come, an exclusive with ECB President Lagarde on how she's navigating some of these global trade challenges and her plan for interest rates, at least. We'll take a quick break here as we continue to watch futures in the green. Busy Tuesday setting up. Squawk on the Streets, back in a moment. Watching shares of J&J this morning, beating quarterly profit estimates, getting a boost from some strong medical device sales. Actually tweaks the guide for the year a little higher.
Yeah.
CFO on Squawk talking about not just moving past the talc liabilities, but actually looking at the plaintiff's bar and
yes.
how that's funded in the future.
Yeah, and you know, a little bit of an upside to that revenue guidance above mid-single digit, which is, you know, certainly welcome. Did seem as if that the street was looking for even a little more on the medical device side, so there's still headwinds. FX might be an issue with the dollar being as strong as it is. But, you know, now cheap stock. It's like under 14 times earnings. Rarely has traded that inexpensively in the last, let's say, 8 or 10 years. So it shows you that it's in that zone of people sort of assuming not a lot of growth. They sort of complete the Kenvue spinoff, and it sort of is what it is. And so it's much more about, I think, whether it gets into that kind of quality portfolio. They raise the dividend for like the 63rd straight year or something like that. And that's what it does, is 3% plus dividend yield. But it feels as if it's not, you know, accelerating, but it's certainly kind of hitting its marks.
I think that's, you can never tell what length chart we're looking at. I think that might be 3 years. That's what I was hoping we'd get. Because that does show earnings have moved up somewhat. And therefore, to your point, multiple obviously continues to move down. This stock has done nothing for at least 3 years.
Time. Yeah.
And a bit more than that.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of where a lot of pharma was until really several months ago. So if you got a lot of the GLP stuff came through, and others have drivers like Merck had also been a good performer, but it's kind of left J&J behind.
Yeah, that underperformance, it's dropped off of a lot of screens for some managers. Let's get the opening bell here at the CNBC Real-Time Exchange. And the big board, as you know, NCAA champions, the University of South Carolina women's basketball team. We just talked to Coach Staley and Camilla Cardoso, most outstanding player of the Final Four, doing the honors. At the NASDAQ, it is Bloomberg Media. As we check some opening levels here, as Mike mentioned earlier, a lot of this Dow gain is going to be encased in UNH.
Yeah, the Dow is mostly about UNH. The S&P is actually at an interesting spot above 5,000 here. Folks were saying, you know, there's areas under 5,000 where it seems like maybe that would contain the initial pullback. I always talk about how we go back in time, not just down in price. So coming into this week, we were kind of back at early March levels when Powell had said, we see our way clear to a rate cut pretty soon, and we had a perfect jobs report on March 8th. And so you kind of check the premises along the way. Where we are right now is the day of the NVIDIA pop after its earnings. So again, you kind of go to this moment in time where you said, wow, a lot of stuff's working all at once, and see if you get some support by the idea that on the earnings side, at least in the AI themes, nothing's much has changed, certainly not for the worse.
Speaking of things that have changed for the worse, Tesla stock price continues to deteriorate, and I think it's worth spending a moment on again. This is obviously the very early going here. Somewhat mixed picture as we get started with trading. The S&P, let's call it flat. NASDAQ is already down. But Tesla shares down some 3.3%. You can see it right there. It's below a $500 billion market cap for the first time I can remember, Mike, in some time. Half a trillion sort of has been that one of that key levels. Obviously, it's been more than a $1 trillion market value. It hit a high of, I think, $1.2 trillion.
$1.2, yeah.
We've discussed ad nauseum the issues facing the company in terms of demand for its product, what seems to be at least slowing growth in terms of overall demand for EVs, but even more so the challenges that Tesla faces from the likes of the Chinese EV makers, both in the domestic market in China, but also in important markets that Tesla competes in with them, exporting from its own Shanghai factory, which is as much as 50% of its overall production.
Yeah.
It's not just the layoffs yesterday, and I made the point that sometimes, many times, stocks react positively to layoff news. That wasn't the case. But also the departure of a couple of key executives as well with long tenures at the company.
Absolutely. It seems as if first of all, it's just a lot of the assumptions that got into the valuation have been challenged. And so, yes, it's the idea that they have a head start that's unassailable and that they're going to be able to charge premium prices and they're going to keep ramping volumes. I just look at what happened in the earnings estimates. They're down 30% for this year and next year in the last 4 months or 5 months. Right now, for 2025, they're not supposed to earn $4 a share. You're $4, you know, you're 40 times, you know, next year's supposed earnings. And J.P. Morgan has been at an underweight on Tesla for a while. And they kind of reiterate that today. And they basically say the retrenchment in employment and capacity is far reaching implications for the hypergrowth narrative still embedded in Tesla's share price, suggesting material downside. So that's what's being bled out of this valuation, this idea that they now, of course, they're going to talk about full self-driving. They're going to talk about, you know, the software elements of the business, the subscription base. But it's just not enough to overcome what seemed like demand problems for all categories of EVs that they're not immune from.
And it was obviously confirmed by those delivery numbers, which were far below what the street had anticipated.
Exactly. And that was the other reason that I think that the pretty hefty layoff announcement did hit in a negative way, which was you can no longer say this is a supply issue or, you know, it's obviously demand constrained, not supply constrained.
For his part, Elon Musk sort of saying, hey, every 5 years we've got to kind of retool, so to speak, for the next growth cycle.
Right. Yeah, I guess the question is, what is, you know, they haven't done a great job of sort of filling the forward pipeline of these models are coming out, they're going to be compelling, they're at a different price point.
Suggests material downside risk. That's the J.P. Morgan note. They're looking for revenue could decline 13 year on year for the coming quarter, and we'll get those results next week. The other story comes out of Electric, which actually broke the layoff news yesterday, now saying that despite Musk's denials that they have, in fact, put a $25,000 car codenamed the NV9 on the back burner.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we'll see what the, I mean, August 8th is still a ways away for the robo-taxi.
It is true, yeah. So I don't know if he's trying to, you know, massage the details and say that the robo-taxi initiative is still live and that might be the same platform as the $25,000. The point being, in the here and now, what we can visibly observe in terms of this quarter, next quarter, in the direction of earnings estimates, it's just a tough sell. Now, I pointed out before, this is right where you look at the chart there, where you actually have found some buyers around the $500 billion market cap. So we'll just see if that matters in the short term as it gets a little bit stretched to the downside.
Yeah, it wouldn't be a 52 week low until 152.37. Yeah. So we're not quite there. That said, upgrade of Rivian today over at UBS, and more continued data on hybrid growth in Q1 up 47 versus EVs up 3 for industry.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the Rivian, you know, upgrade seemed to just be, you know, it's down enough. You know, it's 70% off its highs, and let's not you know, be greedy about the negative call at this point. So what's also, wasn't there an upgraded GM today as well because of that sort of general story and this kind of steady state demand plus the buyback? And obviously, if this perception that slowing investments into lower return EVs is now the assumption, and you know, it gets a little bit of a bump there.
Yeah. Rivian shares, of course, I mean, that company at one point did have a $100 billion market value, if I recall.
I think briefly,
right? Wasn't
so,
it briefly,
yeah.
Like, over $130 a share immediately after it's there
it came
is.
Public,
there
yeah.
is the, yeah. I mean, so even, yeah, there you go. 82% decline over 3 years. Still a $8+ billion market value, obviously. They are meeting delivery estimates, at least at this point.
Yeah.
And as Mike said,
you see them around, you know,
yeah,
the cars.
Yeah, usually see them around. So. Yeah. Yeah,
kind of interesting,
maybe what it
I guess.
Amounts
but,
to.
Yeah.
And obviously, the large Amazon contract remains an
right.
important component of overall sales for them.
For sure.
Yeah.
Got some initiations to work with today. Another one on Reddit as B of A initiates Neutral. Goldman initiates GE Vernova today, I think with a buy. DraftKings, Goldman again with a buy. Certainly, talking to the coach this morning about women's sports and rights and the interest that naturally feeds into betting, for example.
Yeah, it's DraftKings up a couple percent on that. You know, I feel like there's just this general sense out there of maybe we reached a point with sports betting, whether it's just so competitive or we've had such this build out and you've had all the wave of legalizations, that maybe it's going to sort of plateau a little bit. Hasn't really been the case, and DraftKings continues to sort of get its share. It still remains to be seen if this is going to be, you know, a really attractively profitable business long term. Honestly, it's just it's kind of they're making it up on volume at this point. But as long as the sort of overall total value bet numbers keep going up, it seems like the story remains intact.
Guys, I want to mention shares of Live Nation this morning as well. A news story out yesterday from the Journal saying that antitrust authorities at least may be moving towards an action against that company, a lawsuit, antitrust lawsuit. There you see it right there. Live Nation owns Ticketmaster. At the time that deal was actually approved, I think there were many who were surprised, perhaps, that it was approved, given there was always a concern about the issuance of the tickets and the control of that market, and obviously the company that also controls the venues as well. That said, there's been a consent decree, there's been a monitor, and jumping to the conclusion that the DOJ is going to move here to file a lawsuit may be a bit premature. Certainly, one would expect there to be conversation, as there very well may have been. And again, with a consent decree in place and monitored, it's not exactly, Mike, clear what the ask is here.
Yeah.
In terms of the DOJ. I don't know. It wasn't clear specifically, I think, from the Journal's reporting at this point. But the stock is taking a bit of a breather here. It had been actually looking down even more in the very early going. Nonetheless, it may be a while here until it's even clear. And obviously, if they were to bring a case and try to break the company up, that would be a years-long process.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, in terms of what the ask is, I mean, is presumably they look at the exclusive contracts for all the different venues, and it's how they have that kind of vertical lock.
Yes,
on
and
the
they
business.
Have to prove that there's right that they're that they've been precluding real competition
right.
as a result of their significant market share. But they did have a consent that went along with it, you know, and have they been violating it in some way? And again, the company would say, listen, and even if you have complaints, you don't even call, it's a monitor that you actually, that exists, that you call and interact with somehow. So, you know, I do think that while investors may be and have been waiting for this as a possibility, again, it's not clear exactly what they've done wrong and what is going to be done to change that behavior.
Maybe did Taylor Swift call the monitor line and
maybe, yeah,
register
maybe
her complaints?
Maybe.
And
that
you
obviously
know.
Put them under the microscope,
yeah.
including clearly the issues that they had in terms of those, the demand for
the stock case. Came off the boil to some degree. It was like the leading kind of reopening of the economy trade. And then I do think a surprise to the upside as like the pricing for experiences have stayed high. And so, it, you know, it has held most of the pandemic. bump in the stock just because the underlying business has been so good and everyone had kept waiting for, you know, people to get enough of going to events and hasn't happened.
No, it's all about services, right? And in fact, shows up in inflation more so than other parts
exactly.
of the economy.
Yeah. The Rick Reeder chart on NFL tickets. Did you see that? That's
no.
one of his favorite. Yeah.
Is it?
If you just look over the years, like the just list price of NFL tickets.
Who else
roof.
Was making that point? Was it Yardeni maybe that the say the price of an Adidas or a Nike sneaker is virtually unchanged?
Yes. No, wasn't it Larry Fink here?
Was it Fink as well? Was it with Fink on Friday?
Yeah, it was Fink, yeah.
Whereas
yeah.
The price of a concert ticket
exactly.
or a sporting events
yeah.
ticket is.
That's where the scarcity is, and that's where.
Speaking of, yeah. thinking of Yardeni because of what he said last night about crude, interesting to see the S&P go negative, even as
yeah.
oil is also down. We're watching for any indication out of the Israeli war cabinet meeting for a third day in a row today. Various reports about them attempting perhaps to make a response that it does not involve casualties, maybe a
right.
cyber attack. Obviously, just nothing but speculation at this point. But Yardeni's point was that if, in fact, there was a serious geopolitical disruption to crude
yeah.
that took it back to 128, the 2021 highs, that would be reminiscent of the thing we've worried about the most, which is a double top in CPI a la 1974.
Well, that's for sure. Well, there would be that thing you'd worry about whenever there's an oil shock. I mean, recessions have tended to be preceded by, you know, a doubling of oil prices on some level, and that's what that would be. So, yeah, there's all kinds of reasons to worry about that. Also, you know, there's some people saying, like, is there something in the geopolitical events that has the makings of a more accommodative Fed? In other words, is that going to be the thing that sort of is the cover story for why the Fed can get a cut? And I don't think you'd want to ever wish for those circumstances under which that would be what we get. But I just also see, you know, crude down, stocks down, there is just this unwind going on. I mean, the vast majority of stocks are lower again. You have NVIDIA, Microsoft up, as well as UNH, kind of holding the indexes together. But I'm looking at, 85% of New York Stock Exchange volume to the downside again today. And that's been the rule, that when yields are up, there's no more broadening of the market. Small caps underperform. The average stock underperforms the big defensive quality growth stocks.
Yeah. Financials barely holding up. I shouldn't even say holding up. Morgan Stanley is the only gainer off of earnings. Again, we discussed it a bit towards the top of the program. Bank of America shares down some 2.5%, and J.P. Morgan down again. Of course, in this earnings season, at least, the reaction of investors to J.P. Morgan's quarter was the one that was most notable, with the stock declining more than it had in a very long period of time, certainly after earnings. As you can see, Bank of America shares down some 2.6%. I mean, overall, Mike, the quarter looked okay.
It did.
But the financials in general have been, I mean, after what was a very strong first quarter.
Yeah.
Have not looked good these last few weeks.
No,
even
they've been
prior to earnings.
They've been stuck. They are right at the nexus of that. The economy can stay strong and we're going to get the Fed to ease kind of idea.
Yeah.
And so if that starts to take on some water, then I do think that, you know, financials as a group, not as well positioned. J.P. Morgan, I just think, is so much air under. It's been such a strong stock.
True.
You know, Jamie Dimon says we don't really want to buy a lot of it back at these prices. Costs went up when it wasn't expected. So I just think that's a lot of kind of dialing back of the enthusiasm that was
yeah.
built into the stock.
I mean, listen, Goldman got rave reviews from many of the analysts who
first
followed
quarter,
it for
yeah.
that print yesterday. And yet the stock at the end of the day did not end up
yeah.
sharply at all.
Yeah.
It ended up.
Meantime, still to come, an exclusive with ECB's President Christine Lagarde. What's her timetable for cutting rates, if any? But first, check bonds, as we showed you earlier, 10-year well above 4.6 this morning, and that may explain the lack of enthusiasm here. We are working our way through some Fed speak. Powell comes up at 1:15, Williams 12:30, Barkin at 1, S&P holding on to 50-50. Stay with us. Welcome back to Squawk on the Street. Our Sarah Eisen's in D.C. today for the IMF and World Bank spring meetings and has a big exclusive right now. Sarah, take it away.
Okay. Exclusively here in Washington, D.C. is the president of the European Central Bank, Christine Lagarde. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Sarah. Happy to be here.
It's great to see you. You're in town for the IMF World Bank meetings, as always. Interesting timing. Because geopolitics are front and center again. These meetings come after the Iranian attack on Israel. And I do wonder if some of these events change the economic outlook for you at all or impact them.
You know, geopolitical developments have been with us for a long time. And certainly from our perspective in Europe, the developments started in a harsh and difficult way with the unacceptable invasion by Russia of Ukraine. That was a major geopolitical development that had significant economic impact, particularly on the energy front. But then, of course, we had more and more, and some, and not really often commented upon, like Sudan, like Yemen. But obviously, since October 7th, it has been a succession of geopolitical developments which have a bearing on economic activity. I think it has a bearing on, number one, consumer confidence and confidence of investors. You know, where are we heading? What will be the developments? What impact will it have? And it also has an impact on commodity prices. It's not been very significant in the last few weeks, but obviously those geopolitical developments matter a lot. We factor them into our forecast, our modeling as much as we can, and we have to constantly monitor and see how it develops and what impact it has on all these fronts that I have mentioned.
On commodities, oil has been affected, and we watch oil, of course, mm-hmm. with Iran. Brents are trading around 90. If it spikes higher, if there's an escalation, does that become a factor that changes your inflationary outlook for Europe and potentially your policy?
We will obviously, as you say, we are monitoring very closely. The most recent reaction in the last few days has been relatively moderate. It went up, it went down, but it's a moderate movement. We have gone through the period of significant hike of oil prices, and of course we will be informed by that episode. I think that, you know, since the particularly the latest development in Ukraine and the energy crisis that Europe suffered in particular on oil and gas have changed the landscape as well in terms of sources of supply, in terms of dependence, independence, level of inventories, relationship with other countries. And I think that the situation will be different from what it was then. But it does impact, and it does impact across the world, not just the euro area.
It's not just oil that's been rising. We've seen prices from aluminum to cocoa to copper, which is happening at a time where overall Eurozone inflation rates have been coming down.
Yep.
And I wonder how confident you feel about that level continuing to fall in the wake of some of these rises in commodities.
You know, the I think on commodities, we cannot be brought, you know, it cannot be a general assessment. We have to go sort of sector by sector by sector. Because when we look at food, for instance, whether it's processed or unprocessed, you have a first difference. And then cocoa has been a very, has had a significant impact. But you also have to, you know, drill down, taking out cocoa, what is actually the inflation on food. Now, you can't live on cocoa. And all the other elements have to be really measured in that basket of food elements. But all commodity prices have an impact, and we have to be extremely attentive to those movements. Clearly, on energy and on food, it has a direct and rapid impact.
So the market is thinking that you're going to cut rates in June. You've signaled June. Is that still the plan?
You know, we are observing a disinflationary process that is moving according to our expectations. And as I said in our latest press conference after the monetary policy decision that we made to keep rates on hold, we just need to build a bit more confidence in this disinflationary process. But if it moves according to our expectations, if we don't have, you know, a major shock in development, we are heading towards a moment where we have to moderate the restrictive monetary policy that we have applied certainly since September, when we decided to hold rate and to keep that restrictive monetary policy. It will be time, as I said, subject to the no development of additional shock, it will be time to moderate the restrictive monetary policy in reasonably short order.
Sounds like June. That's your next meeting. How do you think about the policy path from there? Is it every meeting gets a cut? Every other meeting?
I've been extremely clear on that. And I have said deliberately, we are not pre-committing to any rate path. Why is that? Because number one, we are data dependent, because there's huge uncertainty out there. I mean, we just spoke about geopolitical development. We have to be attentive to those developments. We have to look at the data. We have to draw conclusions from those data. And we will continue to apply the three key criterias that we have signaled now and which have served us well. You know, it's the inflation outlook, it's the underlying inflation, and it's the strength of monetary policy transmission. So we will, at each and every meeting, particularly when we have projections, but not necessarily only when we have projections, we will look at the evolution and whether or not those data, under these three criteria headline, if you will, confirm our perspective or not. That's what we will do. So,
market expects three this year. Is that reasonable?
You know, I wouldn't comment on that, because if you had asked me 2 or 3 months ago, they were expecting more than three. And I think that we are better off from our, you know, central bank perspective, of course, looking at what they anticipate, because they are big boys and they, too many boys, but they're big boys. And they run their models, they observe things, they take risk, they assess, you know, term premium. But we have to be data dependent. We have to look at our own work, and we are very, very steady and focused on what we are seeing. And we apply judgment at the end of the day. What is produced by these numbers and data and model projections have to be taken into account with judgment on the part of the governors.
All right, I'll try it one other way, which is how restrictive do you see rates right now being for the economy?
I think we have said that we believe that they are restrictive enough and that they are producing an impact. And we're saying by the same token that as data come in the next couple of months, because we will, in April, May will be key moments for data, our confidence will grow that this has been strong enough and we can begin to dial down and moderate the restriction imposed by monetary policy.
On the inflation front in particular, so 2.4% inflation, mm-hmm. You've come a long way down. What does the path to 2% look like?
Bumpy. It will be, and you know, I think it's important to actually understand that, because we have had this very regular, steady decline in the last few months, you know, 2.8%, 2.6, 2.4. I have no idea what the next one will be, but it might not be 2.2. It's not linear. And given the base effects that will be produced by very low prices of energy a year ago, we will have a bumpy road. So rates, inflation rates might go down, might go up a little bit, but they will fluctuate around this line that for the moment is going downwards. And as I said, unless we have major shocks that would disrupt that expectations, we should continue to be directionally down to our 2% target, which we believe we will reach sustainably in mid-25. So that's the expected path of inflation.
Why do you think that inflation has come down farther at this point in Eurozone versus in the U.S., where we're still in the threes?
I think we're talking about two different economies, two different series of shocks, and a different kind of inflation. But what is most different between Europe and the United States of America is the behavior of the consumer. And then we can go into why that is. But I think what we observe is European consumers that are very cautious, that continue to save significantly. When you look at the saving rates in Europe, it is still high and higher than pre-COVID. When you look at the American consumer consumes. And the level of savings overall is less than what it was pre-COVID. That's a major difference. Now, if you go to the root of why is that?
Fiscal.
It's fiscal, it's energy, And it's the natural tendency of the American consumers to have confidence, to spend, not to save so much. But fiscal has played a role. It was significantly higher in this country, and it was targeted to households, to consumers. So when people got a check in the mail, they really had money in their hands that they could spend, and as a result of that, consumed.
You said at the last meeting that you are not Fed dependent, you're data dependent, because the view on the Fed and what we're hearing from policymakers is it's going to be a little bit longer before they think about cutting interest rates. Do you not worry, though, about a gap, a divergence in policy between these two major central banks?
Well, let me explain what I meant by we are not Fed dependent, which I think is absolutely correct. There was a debate about the CPI numbers, which came out, I think, just very briefly before we had our monetary policy decision. And suddenly everybody fretted about that number. And the assumption was, oh, well, if the Fed is going to be delayed, which nobody knows, and I would certainly not make pass a judgment on that, then of course it's going to impact the ECB. The ECB will be delayed. You know, we are data dependent. So our data came down in March. We have had a little bit of data in April. But it's on that basis that we have to make our decisions. And not on the basis of any central bank in the world, be it the Fed, which is the largest and with the largest economy measured by GDP. We cannot make decisions on that basis. Hence, we are not Fed dependent. But what I will say is that the evolution of inflation, the evolution of monetary policy, in any of the large economies that actually have a bearing on the global activity in the world, of course we take into account. And we take that into account in our own measurements and in our own models. So it does find its way in how we forecast. And as I said, one of the three key criterias are inflation outlook. And the other two, but inflation outlook. And that, of course, receives and is informed by multiple data, including what happens in other countries.
And also currencies. I wonder how closely you're following.
You know, central bankers don't talk about currencies as a matter of principle because we don't target currencies.
But it's a transmission mechanism.
Yes. And it does have an impact on inflation. So we have to be very attentive to exchange rates, to the value of currencies, to the value of the euro, and how much it impacts inflation in terms of imported inflation, for instance. Trade is affected also. As well.
If euro goes back to parity, which we're not too far, against the U.S. dollar, is that a good thing or a bad thing for Europe?
As I said, I don't want to comment on exchange rate, any particular number.
Okay, but you're seeing what's happening with the Japanese yen, for instance, which has been plummeting because of the huge interest rate differential between Japan and the U.S. And I do wonder if that factors in and would be a concern if you do go ahead of the Fed in cutting rates.
We will be driven by our data. We will be driven by our analysis of the situation, and we will be targeting this sustainable 2% target that we have, which will determine price stability. This is our mandate. We are single-mindedly focused on that 3% target and price stability. We're looking at lots of other things, including imported inflation, including the volume of trades, including the productivity numbers, the multiple data that find their way into the work that we determine.
European Central Bank President Christine Lagarde talking exclusively with our Sarah Eisen in Washington, D.C. this morning.
You've been listening to the opening hour of CNBC's Squawk on the Street.
All opinions expressed by the Squawk on the Street participants are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of CNBC, NBC Universal, or their parent company or affiliates, and may have been previously disseminated by them on television, radio, internet, or another medium. You should not treat any opinion expressed on this podcast as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of an opinion. Such opinions are based upon information Squawk on the Street participants consider reliable, but neither CNBC nor its affiliates and/or subsidiaries warrant its completeness or accuracy, and it should not be relied upon as such. To view the full Squawk on the Street disclaimer, please visit cnbc.com/Squawk on the Street disclaimer.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.